This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by telephone by Richard Duncan. He's a professor of property and constitutional law at the University of Nebraska College of Law. And the reason he's joining us is because he will be the featured speaker tomorrow at the UND Constitution Day celebration. Professor Duncan, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Your lecture is titled Electoral Federalism from 1789 to 2020, the Presidency and the Senate. That's a dry title, but it's a pretty provocative discussion. So let's get into some definitions to begin here. First of all, the definition of federalism.
Yeah, well, the idea behind federalism is that it's another part of separation of powers. You know, the federal government has separation of powers between the three branches of government, between Congress, the legislative branch, the president, the executive branch, and the courts, the judicial branch. But there's also this other type of separation of powers, that is between the federal government, which is a government only of enumerated powers. The federal government does not have broad plenary powers. They simply have the powers that the Constitution specifically gives to the federal government. And then all other power, and this was made clear under the 10th Amendment, is reserved to the states and we the people in the states through the 10th Amendment. So federalism is really that division of power between the national government on the one hand and the state governments that retain quite a bit of their sovereignty on the other hand.
Constitution Day is September 17th. It's a federal observance that recognizes the adoption of the U.S. Constitution because it was September 17, 1787. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention signed the document in Philadelphia. So that's the historical relevance of having Constitution Day and your appearance at UND tomorrow. But let's go back in history here. What were the various proposals for the handling of presidential elections when the Constitution was being debated?
Right. Well, there was obviously a large debate. Here's the background, is we've got 13 sovereign states. They're loosely connected through the Articles of Confederation, but the states are still very sovereign. They are independent of the federal government. And because the Articles of Confederation didn't create a sufficiently strong federal government, they decided they were going to get together and create a stronger federal government under something called the Supremacy Clause. So if the federal government acts pursuant to its legitimate powers, then those federal laws are the supreme law of the land, and they are binding on the states. And so here we have these 13 independent states, sovereign states, and they're being asked to give up some of their sovereignty. And there was a real concern, particularly between the large population states such as Virginia on the one hand and the small population states such as Delaware and Connecticut on the other hand, that their state interests would be preserved. And so the large states would have liked something that would give more power based upon population. And the smaller states were really very concerned about state equality, sort of one state, one vote, that each state in the union would be equal.
Well, that, of course, is the argument for the Electoral College versus the popular vote.
And also for the United States Senate. I mean, it's really interesting. I sometimes joke that my new favorite founding father is a guy by the name of Gunning Bedford, someone that no one's ever heard of. He was the delegate to the Constitutional Convention from Delaware. And when they were having this debate, he basically said, look, these large population states want an enormous and monstrous power. And there is no way that I will give that to them, and so the great compromise is what we ended up with is the United States Senate was treated with state equality. Each state gets two senators, no matter how large or how small the state. So California, with 35 or maybe now up to 38 million people, get two United States senators. And Wyoming, with a population of about 500,000, they get two United States senators. So that was the part of the compromise that benefited the smaller states. And the larger states got proportional representation in the House of Representatives. And then the electoral system was a combination of the two. Basically, the number of electoral votes each state gets is the number of House seats in the state plus the number of Senate seats in the state. So Wyoming gets three electoral votes, one House seat, two Senate seats. California gets 55 electoral votes, two Senate seats, 53 seats in the House of Representatives. So even the Electoral College is tilted in favor of the large population states, but it is, I guess you would say, it slightly favors the small population states.
Well, that would be North Dakota. We have two senators, one representative, so
right.
We're like Wyoming tilting against
right.
that California windmill.
Yeah, Grover Norquist likes to joke that Wyoming is a state with a population of three, two of whom are United States senators, and one of whom is a member of the House of Representatives. But maybe North Dakota is probably pretty similar. But here's the real benefit, I think, of the electoral system. The reason I think it is continuing to be a source of good, a brilliant, Alexander Hamilton said the system, that he called it excellent. He said it may not be perfect, but it's an excellent system for electing the president. And the reason for that is it doesn't allow the president to be elected by running up the score in one or two or three large population states. It requires a successful presidential candidate to have a national coast-to-coast consensus among the states, because you need to win enough state presidential elections to accumulate enough electoral votes to win an electoral college majority.
So this is the fact that we have no national election in the United States, because every election, as you have written in a paper, for national office is held in the states. So
that's
it's
exactly
the state's
right.
outcome.
We have no true national elections. The people who represent us in the national government are all elected in the states. The House of Representatives, our congressmen, are elected in districts in the states, and they represent their district, not the nation. United States senators are elected in each state, and they represent their state, not the nation. And presidents are elected through state elections for presidential electors. And, you know, so there's a separate presidential election. There are actually 51 popular vote presidential elections. There's not one national popular vote, but there are 51 popular vote elections in the states plus the District of Columbia. And the winner of each state gets the electoral votes for that particular state. So if you win Wyoming, you get Wyoming's three electoral votes, and it doesn't matter what they do in California. It doesn't matter what they do in New York. The candidate who wins Wyoming gets Wyoming's electoral vote. So it is federally democratic, as I like to put it, as opposed to nationally democratic.
Richard Duncan is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Nebraska College of Law. Professor Duncan, a lot has been made of the 3 million vote disparity between the outcome mandated by the Electoral College and the total vote of the most recent popular presidential vote across the country. And I've heard a disparity as large as 5 million votes might be possible. Doesn't that create a political problem? Maybe not a legal one, but a political one.
Well, it shouldn't. I think the 2016 election is an example of the Electoral College performing at its best. If you look, I think Hillary Clinton won by a little. There is no national popular vote, but if you add up all the votes in the states, Hillary Clinton had roughly a plurality. She did not win a majority, but she won a plurality of roughly 3 million votes more than Donald Trump, 3 million popular votes more than Donald Trump. But she won California by more than 4 million votes, and she won New York by more than 2 million votes. So if you set those two states aside, that means Trump actually won the other 48 states by 3 million votes. Plus, Trump won the counties of there are roughly 3,000 counties in America. And Trump won 2,600 and Hillary won just a few over 400 counties. So when you look at the electoral map, you see that the Electoral College is working just the way it was supposed to work. Rather than allow California and New York to exert that monstrous influence that Gunning Bedford talked about in 1787, it required the winner of the presidency to have a national consensus. You know, Hillary Clinton did not win Wisconsin. She did not win Michigan. She did not win several states that she thought she ought to win, and and that hurt her because you need that national consensus, and she didn't get it.
Well, in those states, and you're right, if you look at an electoral college map of the United States in the most recent election, there's an awful lot of red there, state by state.
Almost completely red, yeah.
But if you look at population centers in a lot of those individual states, you'll see a lot of blue.
That's right.
Even within the states, there's this kind of disparity, if you will.
Right.
And over the last, many, many years, besides the Clinton versus Trump election, there have been four other instances of the what is perceived, and I'm stressing that, as the national popular vote versus the electoral vote, where the plurality winner has actually lost the contest.
Right.
And
right.
That does get into an issue of law versus the perception of the law.
Yeah. Well, I think a misperception of the law. If you understand that the purpose of the electoral system is to require a successful presidential candidate to govern by consensus, not just to run up the score. I mean, I like to use a World Series example sometimes. Imagine if the Red Sox and the St. Louis Cardinals are in the World Series, and the Red Sox win Game 1 of the World Series 20-0. And then the Cardinals win the next four games 1-0. Well, the Red Sox could claim they won the popular run election, that they scored 20 runs and St. Louis only scored 4 runs. But in fact, St. Louis won 4 games. And it's the, they had a consensus of the games. They won by a consensus of the games. And that's what we're talking about here. It's not enough to run up the score. In Los Angeles and New York City and San Francisco and Chicago and maybe one or two other large urban areas, you have to have a campaign. You have to have an agenda that you offer the people that can win a consensus among the country. You can't ignore all of those big red states in the middle of the country. You have to appeal to them as well. You can't just run in the big cities. And again, that was the whole reason for this compromise, is that the delegates from the small states were worried that they would be dominated by the large population states, by the enormous and monstrous voting power of the large states. And they created a system that would require government by consensus rather than government by raw national popular vote. The United States is a federal republic, not a unitary national democracy.
Richard Duncan is a professor of constitutional law. He'll be speaking at the Constitution Day celebration at UND on Tuesday. It takes place at the School of Law Baker Courtroom. It's free and open to the public, and it'll take place at noon. It's sponsored by the UND School of Law Federalist Society, and we've been talking about the Electoral College and the way we select senators and presidents in the United States. And you were talking about the preponderance, obviously, of the electoral support for the most recent president, the one currently in office, Donald Trump. There's a complication here, though, not just with the perceived national popular vote and the misperception of the law that drives the Electoral College. We do have a president who, by lots of analysis, is playing to a base and not a broad national consensus. And that seems to be a little bit of a fly in the ointment here.
Well, I think they play to the base until they're running for a national election. And then, you have to win Peoria. You have to win Indiana and Michigan and Wisconsin. And so you can't just play any more than the Democrats are running to their base, basically free everything for everybody. That's they're appealing to the small economic democratic socialist base of the party. But to win election, you've got to go broader than that. So what you often will see, in primaries, they'll run to their base because the base are the ones who are most likely to show up at primaries. But then when it's the Democrats versus the Republicans in the national election, they have to kind of move toward the center. I think Trump – I think Trump is running on the economy, which has broad support. It's the economy is great. Unemployment is down, and wages are up, and taxes have been cut. And I think those are things that are broadly popular. Now, of course, you know, when he tweets, he's tweeting to his base. But when he governs, I think he's governing in a way that people throughout the country can appreciate. The economy, people throughout the country can appreciate his support for tax cuts, and I guess we're really divided on immigration, but I think most of us would like somewhat sealed borders, but a lot of mercy for people who are already here. And my guess is that's, you know, where they'll eventually come out if they can ever sit down and reach a bipartisan deal on immigration.
Well, we almost unavoidably are creeping into political science here as opposed to
right.
the law. But so I want to bring this back
right.
to a very specific question, because I think there has been an instance or two of this. Are the electors of the Electoral College bound to vote for a particular presidential candidate?
Well, I mean, that's not clear. The Tenth Circuit just said that they are free to vote for whoever they want to vote for. And you know that once they're elected, they are their judgment is in place. And there's some support for this. The founders did not have a lot of trust in sort of popular democracy. The founders thought that in fact, we don't even have to have presidential elections under the original Constitution, under the Constitution as it continues to be written today. The states, each state gets to decide how to select presidential electors. We don't need to have an election. George Washington did not get one popular vote. George Washington was elected unanimously by the Electoral College, but he did not get one single vote because each state simply selected the electors who then voted for President Washington. So we don't even need to have elections. And the founders believe that these electors, you know, should be able to exercise a certain amount of discretion, that we were electing them, not the presidential candidates. So there's one argument that, and I think the Tenth Circuit just held this, that electors are free to, to vote their conscience. I think that would be a big mistake. I think if you have elections and the people of, whatever, say the people of North Dakota vote for President Trump, the electors ought to basically respect that vote. Once we've decided to have electors elected democratically, I believe the electors have a moral duty to respect that vote, but it's not clear that they have a legal duty to do so. Indeed, there were some faithless electors in the last election. I think there were four or five electors who voted their conscience. And so President Trump's majority in the Electoral College actually increased because I think Hillary Clinton lost more faithless electors than President Trump lost.
Well, as a student of federalism and an advocate of the Electoral College, what do you see as the strongest arguments against your position?
I think if you want to have a completely different system of government, if you said, what's this states thing? Why don't we just have one big old country? Let's call it America. Let's take the United States out of it and just call it America. Then, I guess there's a reasonable position that we ought to have a unitary national democracy and have no states at all. Now, that's not what I like. And if we had a brand new constitutional convention and that's what was being proposed, I would be suggesting that my state stay out of that and not bother to ratify that constitution. But, I suppose you could say we ought to have one big national democracy. But if we have that, then you have to recognize that those large population centers are going to be able to dictate whatever they want with one-size-fits-all national laws that govern us all. The beautiful thing about federalism is if we can prevent the federal government from sticking its nose into every single matter, the federal government stays out of some issues, then we have what I call 50 shades of federalism. Every state can go their own way. California can have laws that work for Californians, and North Dakotans can have laws that work for North Dakotans. And those might be completely different laws. I mean, this is what we had with marriage until the Supreme Court intervened and declared same-sex marriage on all 50 states. We had a system where California was free if they wanted to recognize same-sex marriage, and say North Dakota was free if they wanted to continue with traditional marriage. But then the Supreme Court nationalized the issue of marriage, and now it's one size fits all. I don't particularly like one size fits all laws on a country that's as diverse as our country is. I think we need lots of different shades of federalism, lots of different sizes that fit different types of people.
Well, on your last example, I think you'd get a vigorous debate. And, of course, Nebraska has this unique unicameral legislature. So
right.
I guess one size doesn't fit all, and it's a very interesting amalgam of states that we live among. Richard Duncan, thank you for spending some time with us today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Richard Duncan is a professor of property and constitutional law at the University of Nebraska College of Law. He'll be speaking at the Constitution Day celebration tomorrow at the UND campus in the Baker Courtroom. It's free and open to the public, and the title of the lecture is Electoral Federalism from 1789 to 2020, the Presidency and the Senate.